Chapter 4, Architecture of Emotional and Psychosomatic Disorders, Part 3.
They might extol the wonders of LSD treatment and spin messianic and grandiose plans to transform the world by making it possible for every human being, and especially politicians, to have the same experience. The breakdown of the superego restraints results in seductiveness, promiscuous tendencies, and obscene gestures, behavior, and talk. Extreme hunger for stimuli and social contact is associated with increased zest, self-love, and inflated self-esteem, as well as indulgence in various aspects of life. The need for excitement and the search for drama and action that are characteristic of manic patients serve a dual purpose. On the one hand, they provide an outlet for the impulses and tensions that are part of the activated BPM-3. On the other hand, engaging in external turbulent situations that match the intensity and quality of the inner turmoil helps to reduce the intolerable emotional cognitive dissonance that threatens manic persons. The terrifying realization that their inner experiences do not correspond to external circumstances. And naturally, a serious discrepancy between the inner and the outer implies insanity. Otto Fenichel pointed out that many important aspects of mania link it to the psychology of carnivals, which provide an opportunity for the socially sanctioned unleashing of otherwise forbidden impulses. This further confirms the deep connection of mania with the dynamic shift from BPM-3 to BPM-4. In the final stages of the death-rebirth process, many people spontaneously experience visions of colorful carnival scenes. Like in the real-life Mardi Gras pageants, this can include images of skulls, skeletons, and other death-related symbols and motifs, which appear in the context of exuberant celebration. In holotropic states, this occurs in the culmination of BPM-3, when we start feeling that we might prevail and survive our confrontation with death. When individuals experiencing this state can be convinced to turn inward, to face the difficult emotions that remain unresolved and complete the rebirth process, the manic quality disappears from their mood and behavior. In its pure form, the experience of BPM-4 is characterized by radiant joy, increased zest, deep relaxation, tranquility, and serenity. In this state of mind, people have a sense of inner peace and total satisfaction. Their joy and euphoria are not exaggerated to the point of grotesque caricature, and their behavior does not have the driven and flamboyant quality characteristic of manic states. The COEX systems psychogenetically related to mania are comprised of memories of situations in which satisfaction was experienced under circumstances of insecurity and uncertainty about the genuineness and continuation of the gratification. Similarly, the expectation of overtly happy behavior in situations that do not justify it seems to feed into the manic pattern. In addition, one frequently finds contrary influences on their self-esteem in the history of manic patients, such as hypercritical and undermining attitudes of one parental figure, alternating with overestimation, psychological inflation, and unrealistic expectations coming from the other one. In several of my European patients, I have observed that the alternating experience of total constraint and complete freedom that characterize the custom of swaddling infants seem to be psychologically related to mania. It is highly unlikely that the complexity of the clinical image of depression and mania could be explained by specific biochemical changes. It would be hard, for example, to imagine a situation more clearly chemically defined than an LSD session, where we know the chemical structure and exact dose of the substance. And yet, our knowledge of the exact chemical composition of the trigger and of the administered dosage is of little help in explaining the psychological content of the experience. Depending on circumstances, the LSD subject can experience an ecstatic rapture or a depressive, manic, or paranoid state. Similarly, the symptomatology of depression or mania cannot be accounted for by some simple or even complex chemical processes. If we detect chemical changes in patients with these disorders, there is always the question of whether biological factors play a causal role in the disorder or are symptomatic concomitants. For example, it is conceivable that the physiological and biochemical changes in manic depressive disorders represent a replay of the physical conditions of a child who is being born. During the LSD sessions in our early psychedelic research in Prague, we followed the oxygen saturation of the blood in the nail beds of our patients using colorimetry. We found that the levels of oxygen in their blood dropped when they were reliving their birth. For those who had just relived a forceps birth, we also observed quadrangular bruises on their temples in places where the instrument had been applied, and bluish stripes on the necks of those who had relived birth with the umbilical cord around their neck. This indicates the possibility that the memory of birth extends all the way to the cellular and even biochemical level. The new understanding of depression that includes the dynamics of basic perinatal matrices offers fascinating new insights into the psychology of suicidal tendencies and behaviors, phenomena which represented a serious theoretical challenge for psychoanalytically oriented interpretations. Any theory that tries to explain the psychology of suicide has to answer two important questions. The first is why a particular individual wants to commit suicide, an act that violates the otherwise mandatory dictate of the self-preservation drive, which is a powerful force that propels the evolution of life in nature. The second, equally puzzling question is the choice of the means of suicide. There seems to be a close connection between the state of mind the depressed person is in and the type of suicide he or she contemplates or attempts. The suicidal drive is not simply an impulse to terminate one's life, but to do it in a particular way. It might seem natural that a person who takes an overdose of tranquilizers or barbiturates would not jump off the cliff or under a train. However, the selectivity of choice also works the other way round. A person who chooses bloody suicide would not use drugs, even if they were easily available. The material from psychedelic research and other forms of deep experiential work with holotropic states throw new light on both the deep motives for suicide and the intriguing question of the chosen method. At the Psychiatric Research Institute in Prague, we had a colleague, a university professor of psychiatry and toxicology, who had easy access to chemical substances and knew everything about their effects and dosages. And yet, in an episode of severe periodic depression, he decided to commit suicide in his office by 3 deep razor cuts through his throat. When one of the nurses found him in the morning lying on the floor of his office, she encountered a gory scene with blood splattered all over his white coat, the carpet, and the papers on his desk. Under the circumstances, an overdose of drugs would seem to be a less drastic and more acceptable solution, but his state of mind seemed to force him to do just what he did. Suicidal ideation and tendencies can occasionally be observed in any stage of work with holotropic states. However, they are particularly frequent and urgent at the time when subjects are confronting the unconscious material related to the negative perinatal matrices. Observations from psychedelic and holotropic sessions, as well as from episodes of spiritual emergency, reveal that suicidal tendencies fall into two distinct categories that have very specific relations to the perinatal process. We have seen that the experience of inhibited depression is dynamically related to BPM-2, and that agitated depression is a derivative of BPM-3. Various forms of suicidal fantasies, tendencies, and actions can then be understood as unconsciously motivated attempts to escape these unbearable psychological states using two routes. Each of these alternatives reflects a specific aspect of the individual's early biological history. Suicide 1, or non-violent suicide, is based on the unconscious memory that the no-exit situation of BPM-2 was preceded by the experience of intrauterine existence. If an individual suffering from inhibited depression finds the situation intolerable and tries to escape it, the most easily available route in this state seems to be regression into the original undifferentiated unity of the prenatal condition, BPM-1. The level of the unconscious involved in this process is usually not accessible unless the individual has the opportunity for deep experiential self-exploration. Lacking the necessary insight, he or she is attracted to situations in everyday life that seem to share certain elements with the prenatal situation. The basic unconscious intention underlying this form of suicidal tendencies and behavior is to reduce the intensity of painful stimuli and emotions associated with BPM-2 and eventually eliminate them. The final goal is to reach the undifferentiated state of oceanic consciousness that characterizes embryonic existence. Mild forms of suicidal ideas of this type are manifested as a wish not to exist, or to fall into a deep sleep, forget everything, and not to awaken ever again. People in this condition might go to bed, cover themselves completely with a blanket, and stay there for extended periods of time. Actual suicidal plans and attempts in this group involve the use of large doses of hypnotics or tranquilizers, and jumping or walking into water and drowning. In countries that have cold winters, this unconscious drive to return to the womb can take the form of walking into a deserted plain or forest, lying down and being covered by a layer of snow. The fantasy behind the situation is that the initial discomfort of freezing disappears and is replaced by feelings of coziness and warmth, like being in a good womb. Suicide by cutting one's wrists in a bathtub full of warm water also belongs to this category. Ending one's life in this way was fashionable in ancient Rome and was used by such illustrious men as Petronius and Seneca. This form of suicide might appear on the surface to be different from others in this category, since it involves blood. However, the psychological focus is on the dissolution of boundaries and merging with the aquatic environment, not on the violation of the body. Suicide 2, or violent suicide, unconsciously follows the pattern once experienced during biological birth. It is closely associated with the agitated form of depression and is related to BPM-3. For a person who is under the influence of this matrix, regression into the oceanic state of the womb is not a feasible option because it would lead through the hellish no-exit stage of BPM-2. This would be psychologically far worse than BPM-3 since it involves a sense of total despair and hopelessness. However, what is available as a psychological escape route is the memory that a similar state was once terminated by explosive release and liberation at the moment of biological birth. To understand this form of suicide, it is important to realize that during our biological birth, we were born anatomically, but did not emotionally and physically process and integrate this overwhelming event. The little crying that we see in newborns after birth, episodes of crying in infancy, and temper tantrums in childhood, which are usually suppressed and truncated by parents using disciplinary measures, are painfully inadequate means for releasing emotions generated during the many hours of suffering in the passage through the birth canal. The individual contemplating violent suicide is using the memory of his or her biological birth as a recipe for coping with the second birth, the emergence of the unassimilated emotions and physical sensations into consciousness that are attempting to be processed and released. As is the case with nonviolent suicide, the individuals involved in this process typically do not have experiential access to the perinatal level of the unconscious. They lack the insight that the ideal strategy in their situation would be to complete the process internally, relive the memory of their birth, and connect experientially with the postnatal situation. Unaware of this option, they exteriorize the process and are driven to create a situation in the external world that involves the same elements as biological birth and that has a similar experiential quality. The basic strategy of violent suicide follows the pattern experienced during delivery: intensification of the tension and emotional suffering to a critical point, and then reaching an explosive resolution amidst various forms of biological material. This description applies equally to biological birth and to violent suicide. Both involve the abrupt termination of excessive emotional and physical tension, an instant discharge of enormous destructive and self-destructive energies, extensive tissue damage, and the presence of organic material such as blood, feces, and entrails. The juxtaposition of photographs showing biological birth and those depicting victims of violent suicide demonstrate the deep formal parallels between the two situations. It is thus easy for the unconscious to confuse one with the other. The connection between the type of birth trauma and the choice of suicide has been confirmed by clinical research with suicidal adolescents. The suicidal fantasies and acts that belong to this category involve death under the wheels of a train, in the turbine of a hydroelectric plant, or in suicidal car accidents. Additional examples involve cutting one's throat, blowing one's brains out, stabbing oneself with a knife, or throwing oneself from a window, tower, or cliff. Suicide by hanging seems to belong to an earlier phase of BPM-3, characterized by feelings of strangulation, suffocation, and strong sexual arousal. The element of exteriorizing suffocation seems to be involved in suicides by inhalation of carbon monoxide or domestic gas. The category of violent suicide also includes some culture-bound forms of suicide, such as harakiri and running amok. Running amok was, in the past, seen as an exotic form of suicidal and murderous behavior occurring exclusively in Malaysia. A person afflicted by this disorder ran into a public place, usually a market, and started indiscriminately killing other people with a dagger. He eventually got killed himself or committed suicide. The Malaysians believed that Amok was caused by Hantu Balaian, an evil tiger spirit that entered one's body and caused the heinous acts. In recent decades, episodes similar to Running Amok, involving indiscriminate killing that ends with the death of the aggressor, have become increasingly frequent in the United States and other Western countries. A very disturbing aspect of these episodes has been their growing incidence among adolescents and even school children. As we saw, nonviolent suicide expresses a tendency to reduce the intensity of painful emotional and physical stimuli. The specific choice of means for this type of suicide seems to then be further determined by biographical or transpersonal elements. Violent suicide involves a mechanism of an entirely different kind. As I have already observed, the individuals who were contemplating a particular form of suicide were often already experiencing the physical sensations and emotions that would be involved in its enactment in their everyday life. Experiential work typically intensified these feelings and sensations and brought them into sharp relief. Thus, those persons whose self-destructive fantasies and tendencies focus on trains or hydroelectric turbines already suffer from intense feelings of being crushed and torn to pieces. Individuals who have a tendency to cut or stab themselves often complain about unbearable pains exactly in those parts of their bodies that they intend to injure, or experience pains in those locations during experiential psychotherapy. Similarly, the tendency to hang oneself is based on deep, pre-existing feelings of strangulation and choking. Both the pains and choking sensations are easily recognizable as elements of BPM-3. If the intensification of symptoms happened in a therapeutic situation with adequate guidance, it could result in a resolution of those uncomfortable sensations and have therapeutic results. The above self-destructive tendencies can thus be seen as expressions of unconscious, misunderstood, and misguided attempts at self-healing. The mechanism of violent suicide requires a relatively clear memory of the sudden transition from the struggle in the birth canal to the external world and of the ensuing explosive liberation. If this transition was blurred by heavy anesthesia, the individual would be programmed for the future almost on a cellular level to escape from severe stress and discomfort into a drugged state. This would create a propensity toward alcoholism and drug abuse, or even a tendency to end one's life with an overdose in a person otherwise dominated by BPM-3. Individuals who are under a strong influence of BPM-3 experience extreme inner pressure and say that they feel like a bomb ready to explode at any moment. These aggressive feelings oscillate between focusing on the destruction of external targets and self-destruction. This is exteriorization of the situation in the birth canal. The former is the fury of the organism that is hurting and struggling for breath, and the latter is the introjected force of the uterine contractions. In this situation, murder and suicide are equally possible alternatives or happen simultaneously, such as a mother killing herself and her child. Linking the mechanism of suicide to BPM-3 throws an interesting light on the theory of suicide formulated by Carl Menninger. Sigmund Freud concluded that suicidal persons would not have the energy to commit suicide unless they find a person whom they hate and want to kill. The suicide is then actually the killing of this introjected object. Menninger expanded on Freud's idea, suggesting that suicide requires the simultaneous occurrence of three wishes: the wish to be killed, the wish to kill, and the wish to die. All of these forces are simultaneously present in the final stage of birth. The wish to die in this context does not relate to physical death, but to symbolic death, the death of the ego. When suicidal individuals undergo psychedelic or holotropic therapy and complete the death-rebirth process, they see suicide retrospectively as a tragic mistake based on a lack of self-understanding. The average person does not know that one can safely experience liberation from unbearable emotional and physical tension through a symbolic death and rebirth, or through reconnecting to the state of prenatal existence. As a result, he or she might be driven by the intensity of discomfort and suffering to seek a situation in the material world that involves similar elements. The extreme outcome is often tragic and irreversible. The drive that these people feel is not really to destroy their body, but to experience psycho-spiritual death and rebirth. As we have seen earlier, the experiences of BPM-1 and BPM-4 do not only represent regression to symbiotic biological states, but also have very distinct spiritual dimensions. For BPM-1, it is the experience of oceanic ecstasy and cosmic union. For BPM-4, that of psycho-spiritual rebirth and divine epiphany. From this perspective, suicidal tendencies of both types appear to be distorted and unrecognized cravings for transcendence. They represent a fundamental confusion between suicide and egocide. The best remedy for self-destructive tendencies and the suicidal urge, then, is the experience of ego death and rebirth and the ensuing feelings of cosmic unity. The fact that the transition between BPM-3 and BPM-4 has an important spiritual component provides a new understanding of a phenomenon that in recent decades has been playing an increasingly important role in the world: the religiously motivated combination of suicide and murder. We have already discussed and explained the combination of suicide and murder as a manifestation of BPM-3. The numinosity of BPM-4 contributes the religious dimension in the form of a divine reward for this act. In World War II, Japanese kamikaze pilots had their airplanes specially built or converted from conventional aircrafts and loaded with bombs, torpedoes, and full fuel tanks, which destroyed American ships by colliding with them. They believed that they were doing it for Emperor Hirohito, who was seen in Japan as a representation of God. Muslim suicide bombers believed that killing infidels while sacrificing their own lives will be rewarded by admission to a paradise with beautiful gardens, luscious trees bearing exquisite fruit, exotic birds, and rivers of pure water, honey, and oil. Among the extraordinary delights that will await them will be unlimited hosts of huris, ravishing black-eyed young women waiting to serve the pleasures of the faithful. The sexual potency of the men would be multiplied 100 times, and, having satisfied the sexual desires of their clients, the huris would resume their virginal status. Alcoholism and drug addiction. The observations from holotropic states of consciousness are in general agreement with psychoanalytic theory that sees alcoholism and narcotic drug addiction as being closely related to manic depressive disorders and suicide. They differ considerably, however, in regard to the nature of the psychological mechanisms involved and the level of the psyche on which they operate. Like suicidal individuals, addicts experience a great amount of emotional pain, such as depression, general tension, anxiety, guilt, and low self-esteem, and they have a strong need to escape these unbearable feelings. We saw earlier that the psychology of depression and suicide cannot be adequately accounted for by oral fixation, which is the interpretation offered by Freudian psychoanalysis. The same is certainly true for alcoholism and drug addiction. The most basic psychological characteristic of alcoholics and addicts, and their deepest motive for taking intoxicant drugs, is not only the need to regress to the breast, but also a much deeper craving for the experience of the blissful unity of the undisturbed intrauterine life. As we saw earlier, regressive experiences of both of these symbiotic states have intrinsic numinous dimensions. The deepest force behind alcoholism and addiction is thus an unrecognized and misguided craving for transcendence. Like suicide, these disorders involve a tragic error based on an inadequate understanding of one's own unconscious dynamics. Excessive consumption of alcohol or narcotic drugs seems to be a mitigated analog of suicidal behavior. Alcoholism and narcotic drug addiction have frequently been described as slow, prolonged forms of suicide. The principal mechanism characteristic for these two groups of patients is the same as the non-violent variety of suicide. It reflects an unconscious need to undo the discomfort of the birth process and return to the womb, to the state that existed prior to the onset of delivery. Alcohol and narcotics tend to inhibit various painful emotions and sensations and produce a state of diffused consciousness and indifference towards one's past and present problems. This state bears some superficial similarity to fetal consciousness and the experience of cosmic unity. However, these resemblances are only superficial, and there are some fundamental differences between alcoholic and narcotic intoxications and transcendental states. Alcohol and narcotics dull the senses, obnubilate consciousness, interfere with intellectual functions, and produce emotional anesthesia. Transcendental states are characterized by a great enhancement of sensory perception, serenity, clarity of thinking, abundance of philosophical and spiritual insights, and an unusual richness of emotions. In spite of some shared features, the intoxication with alcohol and hard drugs represents just a pitiful caricature of the mystical state. Yet the similarity, however tenuous, seems to be sufficient to seduce the addicts into self-destructive abuse. William James was aware of the fact that what alcoholics were searching for was transcendental experience. He expressed this very succinctly in his book, Varieties of Religious Experience. The best treatment for dipsomania, an archaic name for alcoholism, is religiomania. C.G. Jung expressed the same idea in a different way. In his correspondence with Bill Wilson, the founder of AA, he wrote about an alcoholic patient. His craving for alcohol was the equivalent, on a low level, of the spiritual thirst of our being for wholeness, expressed in medieval language, the union with God. Jung pointed out that in Latin, the term spiritus covers both meanings, alcohol and spirit. He then suggested that the proper formula for treating alcoholism is spiritus contra spiritum. It expressed his belief that only a deep spiritual experience can save people from the ravages of alcohol. James's and Jung's insights explain the success that the Native American Church has had in helping alcoholic Native Americans by evoking spiritual experiences in peyote ceremonies. Their results have since been confirmed by clinical research with psychedelics. The tendency to escape the painful emotions associated with BPM-2 and related COX systems through an attempt to recreate the situation in the womb appears to be the most common psychodynamic mechanism underlying alcoholism and drug abuse. However, I have also worked with alcoholics and addicts whose symptoms indicated that they were under the influence of BPM-3 and yet sought the pharmacological solution for their problems. This clearly involved an alternative mechanism and required a different explanation. As for those clients for whom I could get information about their birth, I found out that they were born under heavy anesthesia. This explanation certainly makes sense. Birth is typically the first major painful and stressful situation we encounter in our life. Unless major crises occurred during embryonic existence, the extraordinary influence of early events in life on subsequent behavior has been repeatedly documented in experiments by ethologists, researchers studying animal instinctual behavior. This is known as imprinting. The nature of our birth and the way it was handled has a powerful impact on our future life. When our birth is of average duration and severity, and we emerge into the world after having successfully negotiated the challenges, it leaves us with a feeling of optimism and confidence toward the difficulties that we encounter in the future. Conversely, an extended and debilitating delivery creates a sense of pessimism and defeatism. It forges an impression of the world as being too difficult to cope with successfully, and of ourselves as being helpless and ineffective. If the pain and discomfort associated with our birth is alleviated or terminated by anesthesia, it leaves a very deep and convincing imprint in our psyche that the way to deal with difficulties in life is to escape into a drug state. It might not be a meaningless coincidence that today's epidemic of drug abuse in the United States involves the generation of people who have been born since American obstetricians started routinely using anesthesia during childbirth, often against the will of the delivering mothers. Since the founding of the Association of Prenatal and Perinatal Psychology, a discipline that applies the findings of experiential therapies and fetal research to birth practices, obstetricians are becoming increasingly aware of the fact that birthing involves more than just body mechanics and that it can have a profound influence on the life of the newborn. The way delivery and the postnatal period are handled has a profound influence on the emotional and social life of the individual and has important implications for the future of our society. It lays the foundations for either a loving and altruistic relationship with fellow humans, or for a mistrusting and aggressive attitude toward society. It may also be a critical factor in determining whether the individual will be able to cope with the vicissitudes of life in a constructive way, or will tend to escape the challenges of existence by opting for alcohol or narcotics. The fact that alcoholism and narcotic drug abuse represent a misguided search for transcendence can also help us understand the healing and transformative effect of profound crises that are usually referred to as hitting bottom. In many instances, reaching a state of total emotional bankruptcy and annihilation becomes a turning point in the life of the alcoholic or drug addict. In the context of our discussion, this would mean that the individual experienced ego death as part of the transition from BPM 3 to BPM 4. At this point, alcohol or narcotics are not able to protect him or her anymore from the onslaught of the deep unconscious material. The eruption of the perinatal dynamics then results in a psychosomatic death-rebirth experience that often represents a positive turning point in the life of the alcoholic or addict. Like all emotional problems, alcoholism and addiction have not only biographical and perinatal, but also transpersonal roots. Most important among these are influences from the archetypal domain. This aspect of addiction has been particularly explored by therapists with a Jungian orientation. Among archetypes that show important connections with addiction, that of the puer eternus, with its varieties of Icarus and Dionysus, seem to play an important role. Many people with whom I have worked also discovered karmic material that seemed to be meaningfully related to their addiction. Sexual disorders and deviations. In classical psychoanalysis, the understanding of sexual problems rests on several fundamental concepts formulated by Freud. The first of these is the notion of infantile sexuality. One of the basic cornerstones of the psychoanalytic theory is the discovery that sexuality does not manifest in puberty, but in early infancy. As the libido develops through several evolutionary stages, oral, anal, urethral, and phallic, frustration or overindulgence in any of them can lead to fixation. In mature sexuality, the primary focus is genital, and the pre-genital components play a secondary role, mostly as part of the foreplay. Specific psychological stress in later life can cause regression to earlier developmental stages of libidinal development where fixation occurred. Depending on the strength of the defense mechanisms that oppose these impulses, this can result in perversions or psychoneuroses. An important concept in the psychoanalytic approach to sexual problems is the castration complex. Freud believed that both sexes attribute extreme value to the penis, and he considered this to be an issue of paramount importance for psychology. According to him, boys experience excessive fear that they might lose this highly valued organ. Girls believe that they once had a penis and lost it. They wonder why that happened, and it makes them more prone to masochism and guilt. Freud's reviewers repeatedly criticized this point of view as a serious distortion and misunderstanding of female sexuality, since it portrays women essentially as castrated males. Leaving out some important aspects of women's life, such as pregnancy, childbirth, and motherhood, and believing that the most important issue for them is having or not having a penis, certainly creates a seriously slanted and biased feminine psychology. Another cornerstone of Freud's sexual theory is the Oedipus complex, the sexual attraction that boys feel toward their mothers and aggression they experience toward their fathers. This is associated with a fear of punishment for these feelings in the form of castration by their fathers. The feminine counterpart of the Oedipus complex, the girls' affection for their fathers and hatred toward their mothers, has been referred to as the Electra complex. The discussion of Freud's understanding of sexuality would not be complete without mentioning another important concept, his famous vagina dentata, the observation that children see the female genitals as a dangerous organ equipped with teeth, which can kill, swallow, or castrate them. Together with the Oedipus and Electra complexes and the castration complex, the fantasy of the ominous female genitals plays a crucial role in the psychoanalytic interpretation of sexual deviations and psychoneurosis. Freud suggested two reasons for which the sight of female genitals may arouse anxiety in boys. First, the recognition that there are human beings without a penis leads to the conclusion that one might become one of them, which lends power to their castration fears. And second, the perception of the female genitals as a castrating instrument capable of biting is due to an association with old oral anxieties. None of these two reasons is particularly compelling or convincing. The observations from holotropic states radically expand and deepen the Freudian understanding of sexuality by adding the perinatal domain to the individual unconscious. They suggest that we do not experience our first sexual feelings on the breast, but already in the birth canal. As I have discussed earlier, the suffocation and agony during BPM-3 seems to generate a sexual arousal of extreme intensity. This means that our first encounter with sexual feelings occurs under very precarious circumstances. Birth is a situation in which our life is threatened, and we experience suffocation, pain, and other forms of extreme physical and emotional discomfort. We inflict pain on another organism, and another organism inflicts pain on us. We are also in contact with various forms of biological material, blood, vaginal secretions, amniotic fluid, and if a catheter and enema are not used, even feces and urine. The typical response to this predicament is a mixture of vital anxiety and rage. These problematic associations form a natural basis for the understanding of the basic sexual dysfunctions, deviations, and perversions. The recognition of the profound influence of perinatal dynamics on sexuality also clears up some serious theoretical problems associated with Freud's concept of the castration complex. Several important characteristics of this complex, as conceived by Freud, do not make any sense as long as we relate it to the penis. According to Freud, the intensity of the castration fear is so excessive that it equals the fear of death. He also saw castration as psychologically equivalent to the loss of an important human relationship and suggested that it could actually be activated by such a loss. Among the free associations that often emerge in connection with the castration complex are those dealing with situations involving suffocation and loss of breath. And, as I mentioned earlier, the castration complex is found in both men and women. None of the above connections would make any sense if the castration complex reflected only concerns about the loss of the penis. Observations from holotropic states show that the experiences, which Freud considered to be the source of the castration complex, actually represent the surface layer of a coex system superimposed over the traumatic memory of the severing of the umbilical cord. All the inconsistencies that I just mentioned disappear when we realize that many puzzling characteristics of Freud's castration complex actually refer to the separation from the mother at the time when the umbilical cord was cut, and not the loss of the penis. Unlike unprovoked spontaneous castration fantasies, facetious verbal threats of castration by adults, and even surgical interventions on the penis, such as circumcision, or correction of the adhesion of the foreskin, phimosis, the cutting of the umbilical cord is associated with a situation that is potentially or actually life-threatening. Since it severs the vital connection with the maternal organism, it is the prototypical loss of an important relationship. The association of the cutting of the umbilical cord with suffocation also makes eminent sense, since the cord is the source of oxygen for the fetus. And last but not least, it is an experience that is shared by both sexes. Similarly, the image of the vagina dentata that Freud saw as a naive infantile fantasy appears in a new light once we accept that the newborn is a conscious being, or at least that the trauma of birth is recorded in the memory. Rather than being an absurd and silly fabrication of the child's immature psyche, the image of the vagina as a perilous organ reflects the dangers associated with female genitals during childbirth. Far from being a mere fantasy with no basis in reality, it represents a generalization of one's experience in a specific, life-threatening situation to other contexts in which it is not appropriate. The link between sexuality and the potentially life-threatening trauma of birth creates a general disposition to sexual disturbances of various kinds. Specific disorders develop when certain aspects of perinatal memories are then reinforced by postnatal traumas in infancy and childhood. As is the case with emotional and psychosomatic disorders in general, the traumatic experiences that the psychoanalysts see as primary causes of these problems actually serve to reinforce and confirm certain aspects of the birth trauma and facilitate their emergence into consciousness.